The Yemeni army says it has targeted the Saudi airbase in Khamis Umshayat with drones less than a day after a similar attack on the Saudi capital Riyadh. The European Union says officials from Iran, China, Russia, France, Germany and Britain will discuss on Friday a possible return of the US to the 2015 nuclear deal. Also ahead, Ukraine accuses Russia of building up troops on the country's border as the US warns Moscow against intimidating Kiev. Good to have you with us. Our top story, the Yemeni army has launched a fresh retaliatory drone strike on targets in Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Sarit said two drones targeted the King Khalid airbase in the southwestern Saudi city of Khamis Umshayat. The Saudi-led coalition claims to have intercepted the drones. The raid comes hours after a similar strike that hit the Saudi capital Riyadh. Yemen says the retaliatory attacks will continue as long as Riyadh's airstrikes and its blockade continue. Saudi Arabia waged its war on Yemen 6 years ago. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have lost their lives as a result. Eric Wahlberg is a writer and journalist and joins us now. Eric, welcome. Can we say a pattern has emerged over the past few years where you have Saudi Arabia, you know, bombing Yemen, killing thousands of civilians? On the other hand, the Yemeni forces are responding by hitting Saudi military bases, oil facilities, hurting the Saudis, but zero casualties on the Saudi Arabian side.
Well, of course, it's David and Goliath. And even though the Houthi have very little backing and very little resources, they're able to prick the big bear, the tiger. And it's very sad that this is just going to keep going until Saudi Arabia stops its war. As soon as it stops its war, it's very much like with the U.S. and Iran right now. If the U.S. would just back off, things will return to normal. So let's hope that Biden will wise up. He's supposedly against the Yemen war, but is very slow to act. He is not a forceful leader in these first few months.
As the Yemeni, as Yemen increases its retaliatory airstrikes, do you think Saudi Arabia is in a quagmire here, and is it looking for a way out of the war that it started 6 years ago?
It's the same situation with Iran, that Biden really should have acted decisively, cut the aid, all aid, really pushed Saudi to stop, and it should have immediately gone back to the JCPOA. And it did not. He did neither. And now he is an embarrassed situation. He better wake up and start acting, or else we're in for a lot of trouble, really.
Okay, Mr. Wahlberg, thank you very much indeed for your time. Eric Wahlberg, the writer and journalist, joining us out of Toronto. And Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held an event in the capital Sana'a to discuss the role of Yemeni tribes in facing the Saudi-led coalition forces. The event also highlighted the key role of Yemeni tribes in supporting the army in different fronts across the country. Abdul Latif Washali has more in this report.
As the Yemeni army is pushing ahead with its offensive to liberate the city of Marib from Saudi-backed forces, Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held an event in the capital Sana'a to discuss the role of the southern and eastern Yemeni tribes in facing the Saudi-led coalition.
Many of the free people in southern Yemen stand beside their country in groups and parties, but they face severe repression from the forces of the coalition in southern regions, which confirms the ugliness of the crimes committed by the coalition against Yemenis. All Yemenis should be working together on a comprehensive plan to liberate all governorates after the liberation of Marib.
Since the beginning of the Saudi war in Yemen, eastern and western tribes played a key role in supporting the Yemeni army with weapons, money, and fighters. The participants say the tribes devoted their efforts to expel the foreign presence from their country.
The southern and eastern Yemeni tribes have many honorable stances, whether by spreading culture and awareness or supporting the political position inside and outside Yemen. They are also supporting the fronts of confrontation with weapons, men, money, and sending food convoys to the fighters on all fronts. The tribes are seeking to expel the foreign occupation from the country.
The Yemeni army has recently intensified its operations to liberate Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen, a move which considered as the first step forward for liberating the rest of the country.
Yemenis agree that the liberation of the country will not succeed without the tribes backing the army, since the tribes themselves refuse the presence of any foreign forces, especially those of Saudi Arabia. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Elsewhere, the European Union says the remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal will attend a virtual meeting to discuss ways to salvage the accord. Representatives from Iran, China, Russia, France, Britain, and Germany will attend the Friday meeting. In a statement, the EU said the U.S. possible return to the JCPOA and ensuring its full implementation by all parties are on the agenda. The U.S. has hailed the meeting as a positive step. Tehran and Washington are at an impasse over which side must act first to save the deal. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani says Tehran has been the only party committed to the agreement, urging other signatories to honor their commitments. Political commentator Frank Emsbach says participants in the JCPOA talks must offer confidence-building measures to save the accord. Here he is.
The fact that the meeting is taking place and apparently everybody's going to be there is a step. I don't know whether it'll turn into a first step, but it's a step in the right direction. We could have said we're not coming. And I think that the fact that there is some movement here, apparently, is a good sign. As I said, it may be that there'll be a couple of confidence-building steps that Iran feels comfortable with and the United States feels comfortable with. My sense is that President Biden has an awful lot riding on things over the next couple of months. He's got the pandemic here, $1.9 trillion in stimulus or COVID bill, another couple of trillion dollars in terms of moving forward with infrastructure and other types of investment in this country, all of which is facing opposition. He's got a crisis, what's going to happen one way or the other with the George Floyd murder trial. And so there's enough things on the plate to make it a very difficult governing situation. And so I think there are pressures within the administration to try to work something out here.
The U.S. State Department has released its annual report on global human rights practices. Part of the report has looked at human rights issues in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. It has fallen short of condemning Israel's violation of international law as well as its atrocities against Palestinians. The report was the first of its kind by the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden.
The annual United States report on global human rights practices looked at human rights issues in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza as part of its global analysis on almost 200 nations. In the first such report of the Biden administration, the U.S. reaffirmed the recognition of Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights and the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That is while Washington has refused to slam the Israeli regime for its illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories, as well as other crimes. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem outputs. That is why the UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Also, according to human rights groups, acts of violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians and their property are a daily occurrence throughout the occupied West Bank. Additionally, Israel holds more than 7,000 Palestinians in its jails. Most of the prisoners are being held with no indictment or trial under a controversial policy known as administrative detention.
Well, in the first place, the U.S. lacks the moral authority to talk about human rights in any country outside of its own boundaries. Inside the U.S., there is systemic racism against people of color and against people of indigenous origin. And this has been going on for 400 years inside the what is now the United States. Their record has been terrible. And to just a couple of days ago, the trial of the police man who killed George Floyd is taking place. So the U.S. has no moral authority whatsoever.
The Israeli regime's crimes seem to have no end, and the international community only condemns the regime's atrocities in words. This is while Israel is violating international law.
In 1967, Israel waged their full-scale war against the Arab territories and occupied the largest swathe of Syria's Golan Heights. 14 years later, Israel unilaterally annexed the Golan Heights in a move never recognized by the international community. But despite the international outcry, the U.S. recognized Israel's sovereignty over the occupied Golan Heights in 2019.
Golan Heights were part of Syria until 1967, when the Israeli regime captured most of the area during the Six-Day War. In 1973, Egypt and Syria launched a war against the Israeli regime in an effort to recapture the occupied territories. However, with Washington's help, Israel managed to retain control over the territory it occupied before. Then in 1981, Israel declared its unilaterally annexing East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights in order to extend its own boundaries to cover the captured territories. In response, the UN Security Council passed Resolution 497 and condemned the annexation of Syrian territory. The Council declared the annexation a violation of international law. Meanwhile, Syria has repeatedly reaffirmed its sovereignty over the Golan Heights, saying the territory must be completely restored to its control. The Golan Heights territory is strategically important due to its military value. It is also a strategic asset due to its water resources and fertile land. In a relatively parched region of the world, control over the Golan's water supplies is invaluable. The Golan Heights may also have oil. Exploratory drilling suggests that the territory's reservoirs could potentially yield billions of barrels of oil. The annual United States Report on Global Human Rights Practices also reaffirmed Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which the U.S. recognized in 2019. In March 2019, the former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a decree recognizing Israeli sovereignty over Golan during a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington. The Syrian government denounced Washington's recognition of Israeli claims over the Golan Heights as a blatant attack on the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Over the past decades, Israel has built dozens of settlements in the Golan Heights in defiance of international calls for the regime to stop its illegal construction activities.
Indeed, they are illegal, and nothing that the U.S. says or does can turn a crime into a legal act. Except for the USA, the entire world recognizes that the Golan Heights are part of the sovereign territory of Syria, and someday Syria will regain control of the Golan Heights.
Elsewhere, the Ukrainian president has accused Russia of building up troops on his country's border. Vladimir Zelensky also claimed that Moscow is seeking to create a threatening atmosphere and pressure Kiev during the upcoming talks on resumption of a ceasefire agreement brokered last year. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department has warned Russia against any attempt to intimidate its neighbors. However, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov dismissed the allegations and said Russia's military movements are within its territory and pose no threat to anyone. Moscow and Kiev have been blaming each other recently for a wave of violence in eastern Ukraine. Zelensky says the violence has killed 20 Ukrainian servicemen since the start of the year. A long-awaited report on racism has been published in the UK. It was commissioned last year after the murder of George Floyd in the US, but was postponed by the pandemic. It seems it has only served to further damage the relationship between ethnic minorities and the British government, though by downplaying their struggle. Bianca Rahimi has more.
The Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparity says the UK system is not rigged against people from ethnic minorities and there is no proof of institutional racism. In a report released Wednesday, it did admit that minorities still face overt racism, but insisted Britain should be regarded as a, quote, model for other white majority countries. The report definitely touched a nerve, suggesting that disparities based on race in the economy and education are negligible. But people here in Brixton definitely disagree.
They live in their little tower and they've grown up in a certain way, but they don't see the reality of what black people are actually going through. So no, there is racism and we are not hung up. We need to just be heard that something is wrong with our bringing up our lives and how we are actually treated, because in reality we are seen as a different colour.
Institutional racism does exist. It exists in the education system everywhere. You can see it in a classroom. A teacher would discriminate against a black student over a white student just because he's black.
The report has been slammed as nonsense that flies in the face of all existing evidence. Flagged up are many issues that black and minority ethnics grapple on a daily basis. For example, the fact that black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people, and black mothers are 4 times likely to die in childbirth. So is this a genuine effort to understand racism in Britain or a PR stunt? Many black artists share the view that racism today is alive and well. Junior from the British Collective says his life and career were deeply impacted by racism.
When I was a kid and I was growing up, if I played football and a white guy kicked me, I would have turned around and I might have effed them blind. But it wouldn't have crossed my mind to call him white. Vice versa, the first thing that he would do is turn around and say, "You black, so and so." Not understanding for himself that he's being racist, he just took it as the norm. It hasn't changed since then. It hasn't changed in any shape, form, or fashion. I hear some politicians trying to turn it into, black politicians trying to turn it into a, oh well, we've come a long way. We haven't.
The COVID-19 pandemic and the disproportionate number of deaths among black, Asian, and minority ethnic people clearly illustrate that something is seriously wrong. Being much more likely to have to live in a block of flats and do a job involving a high level of exposure to the public are the sort of factors that critics say prove systemic or structural racism is real. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Turning to other news, Brazil has recorded over 91,000 new coronavirus cases and nearly 3,800 more deaths as the country grapples with its worst phase of the pandemic. The Latin American nation is emerging as an epicenter of the pandemic. It has so far confirmed nearly 13 million cases and over 325,000 fatalities. The World Health Organization has described the situation in Brazil as very serious, saying a number of its states are in critical condition. The WHO says hospitals are overwhelmed nationwide and over 90% of ICU beds are full. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has come under fire for his handling of the coronavirus. He has repeatedly downplayed the severity of the pandemic, rejecting public health restrictions and lockdowns, while speaking out against vaccines. That brings it into our bulletin for this hour. Thank you very much for tuning in.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In what many Palestinians have described as a continuation of the Nakba, that is Israel's 1948 ethnic cleansing campaign in Palestine, the Zionist regime is currently in the process of expelling thousands of Palestinians from East Al-Quds under the pretext of preservation. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Jessica Boxbaum, an Al-Quds-based journalist for Mint Press News, covering Palestine, occupied territories, and Syria under the heading "An Old Green Colonial Trick: Israel Masking Land Grabs as Environmental Conservation." Please stay with us to hear more about the issue. For decades, a Palestinian village on the southern tip of Al-Quds has lived on and cultivated the land. But a series of recent efforts by the Israeli regime is not only threatening their way of life, but potentially displacing them from their homes. On January 25th, Al-Quds District Planning Committee rejected the residents of Palestinian village Al-Walaja's plan to legalize their homes and further develop the community. Instead, the committee declared their land an ancient agricultural area in need of environmental conservation that should be transformed into a national park. The notion of environmental integrity struck Amy Cohen, Director of International Relations and Advocacy at the Israeli nonprofit Er Amim, as contradictory. Cohen said the planning committee and the Israeli civil administration within the West Bank have been promoting and advancing plans within the same area for illegal Jewish settlers, adding, "It shows massive discrimination in how Israel treats Palestinian areas in order to suppress the residential development." The committee's decision paves the way for the lifting of the demolition freeze on 38 Al-Walaja's home. On April 26, Israel's Supreme Court will convene for a hearing on Al-Walaja 2018 petition over its resident-initiated outline plan. Ibrahim Araj, 37, grew up in Al-Walaja. The home he built for his family in 2016 is now under threat of demolition. Araj expects the court will not rule in Al-Walaja's favor in April, and his house will be demolished. Referring to the planning committee's rejection of the development plan for environmental reason, Araj said, "It's not logical or legal," adding, "The village is surrounded by illegal settlements and the apartheid wall, which destroyed the nature and environmental landscape." The planning committee did not respond to requests for comment. When the Zionist regime annexed East Al-Quds in 1967, it took the northern section of Al-Walaja as well. Today, Al-Walajah is split between Al-Quds and areas B and C of the West Bank. So, one-third of the land is controlled by the Al-Quds municipality and the rest by the Bethlehem Governorate. The Al-Quds area of Al-Walajah has been at risk of forced displacement for a decade as a result of the planning committee's refusal to discuss an outline plan. This refusal has made it impossible for the community to obtain building permits, so Araj had to construct his house without one. Amid the absence of building permits, demolition orders have increased. More than 20 homes have been razed in Al-Walajah since 2016. The Zionist regime authorities have prevented Al-Walajah from developing while expanding Jewish settlements around the village and the apartheid wall, the barrier separating the West Bank and the occupied territories. Construction of the wall on three sides of Al-Walajah cut off the village from nearly 300 acres of its agricultural land and turned that land into Nahal Rephaim National Park. Our Gilo settlement lies to the south of Al-Walajah. The Israel Civil Administration's proposed expansion of the Har Gilo settlement to the west of the village will extend the wall, thereby enclosing Al-Walajah and fully isolating it from its surroundings. The Civil Administration did not respond to requests for comment, mentioning how the villagers are now blocked from the olive trees they harvested before the wall was built. Araj said the wall and the settlements deprived us from accessing our own land that we worked so hard to cultivate. Al-Walajah residents experience harassment daily from the Zionist settlers and authorities. Araj explained, "The civil administration confiscates our equipment when we start building a new house. The settlers around us use drones to take pictures when we start building and send them to the civil administration. The police put checkpoints at the entrance of the village and sometimes inside the village. And the Walajah bypass road connecting Har Gilo settlement to Al-Quds gets a lot of traffic, so it limits our movement." Araj lamented that if his home is demolished, he will likely leave Al-Walajah, the place he has called home, his whole life. He said, "It's a huge tyranny that I have to leave my own house and my own land." The Zionist regime doesn't provide alternative or temporary housing for Palestinians whose homes they demolish. Sari Kronish, East Al-Quds planner for BIMCOM, an Israeli planning rights organization, described the government's lack of consideration in helping displaced families find housing as one of the dark sides of the Zionist regime at the moment. Kronish said the very sad reality is that the authorities don't offer the uprooted Palestinians anything. They just treat them as lawbreakers who are receiving their penalty, adding, "People just become homeless and become displaced." Er Amims Cohen emphasizes that what Israel is enacting isn't just the wide-scale displacement of Palestinians, but also an attempt at annexation. She elaborated, "It's an acute humanitarian toll that's exacted upon the families, but it is also in service to the Israeli objective of consolidating control, which completely undermines any sort of conditions for a two-state solution based on two capitals. Because if you can completely segment Palestinian continuity and advance steps toward de facto annexation of these areas, then you're foiling a prospect of an agreed resolution." In what many Palestinians have described as a continuation of the Nakba, that is Israel's 1948 ethnic cleansing campaign in Palestine, the Zionist regime is currently in the process of expelling thousands of Palestinians from East Al-Quds under the pretext of preservation. Kronish said more and more open areas in East Al-Quds are being designated as preservation or national parks, and this is clearly in order to prevent Palestinian urban development. In the Al-Busta neighborhood of East Al-Quds district of Silwan, mass disposition looms over the residents in order to make room for the touristic venture, Garden of the King. The community of Sheikh Jarrah is experiencing displacement at the hands of settler groups for the Shimon Hatzik National Park. The Zionist regime has long employed the practice of stealing Palestinian land and claiming for recreational purposes. Many of the Zionist regime's prized national parks were built on top of Palestinian villages destroyed during the Nakba. For instance, in Al-Quds, the remains of the village of Lifta are now a national park and hotel. Garbage and graffiti adorn what's left of Lifta stone houses. Most of the village's inhabitants, who were expelled in 1948, and their descendants live in refugee camps around Al-Quds, unable to return to home. Kronisch said, "It's a form of institutional confiscation and settlement in the guise of green protection. Displacing indigenous peoples under the claim of conservation is an inherently settler colonialist tactic spanning regions and centuries. Most well-known national parks in the United States, like Yellowstone and Yosemite, were once Native American tribal territories. In order to create an uninhabited wilderness, the federal government first had to remove the native peoples living on that land. Modern environmentalism ignorantly dictates some environmentalist assumptions, suggest humans cannot coexist with wildlife. But that racist assumption idea ignores the history of indigenous communities living with and preserving nature. Native Americans understood how to sustainably tend to the land. And just as in Al-Walaja, maintaining the land is part of their livelihood." Kronisch explained, "This type of agricultural lifestyle is very dependent on people living on and working the land harmoniously. Once people are displaced, attempts at preservation became artificial. The residents would argue that by continuing to live there, they are more able to continue to preserve. For them, it's not a question of preservation, it's a question of a way of life and connection to the land."
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and today on the 42nd anniversary of the nationwide referendum, when 97% of people of Iran voted for the Islamic system of government under the leadership of Velayat-e Faqih, or the most knowledgeable jurisprudent, in the absence of the Lord of the Age, the Holy Prophet's 12th and last infallible heir, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance to establish a government of peace and justice. Let us listen to what the awaited savior of mankind has said in this regard. In case of occurring social problems, refer for guidance to those who relate from us, for they are my hujjah, or argumentation over you, and I am Allah's argumentation over them.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd As-Salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-Tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and our program For Humanity, where we are discussing the treatise of rights of Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him. We're in the area of talking about haqqul mustansih, the right of one who seeks your counsel. And we've been speaking about what it is that you need to do when you are in that area of wanting advice or giving advice. You need to make sure always that the words that you are going to be delivering in your counseling, in your advice, in your guidance is carefully chosen. Because when you choose the wrong word or the wrong expression, it might have counterproductive effects. And therefore, it might be interpreted the wrong way. It might, instead of it being something that is guiding that person, it's going to misguide them. And therefore, this is why you look at our imams and you see how they were able to be so precise in the selection of words that they chose. Sometimes direct, sometimes indirect. And all of that would have a profound effect on the other person. And that's exactly what we mean when we say that, for example, the particular approach of our Imam alayhim as-salam, whether it meant in the time of them saying a statement, delivering a hadith, or maybe in the form of dua, for example. You know, maybe you can certainly come across many cases where a dua delivered by one of our imams, especially the likes, for example, the likes of Imam Hussein, Imam Sajjad, peace be upon them, gave nasiha and gave advice through the form of using those lofty, beautiful expressions that we can see in their ad'iyya and in their supplications. Now, when you have the correct approach, when you are dealing with something in, as far as consultation, as far as counseling, maybe directly, maybe indirectly, maybe consciously, maybe subconsciously, it's going to have a positive effect on those who are around you. But you need to make sure that you choose an approach, that this becomes a skill for you. You know, that it's not just something that, well, you just throw it out there and you say what it is and you don't face the consequences of what it is that just was just said by you. Because when you open your tongue to give advice, then you need to make sure that an ear will hear it. When an ear does hear it, then you need to make sure that it's going to have a positive effect and not something that is negative in any way. Look at the beautiful examples that we can see in the Holy Quran with Luqman and his son. And the way that the Quran describes Luqman's language as it being, you know, when you look at it, it's if you know that there's a sense of softness, that it's gentle, that it's with love, that it's with modesty. And that's how a nasiha should always be. We're just going to go for a short break and we will be back very, very soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. And we were talking about how the Holy Quran describes Prophet Luqman's approach when he's giving advice to his son and the beautiful way that he delivers that kind of consultation or advice or nasiha, and the combination of the sentences and words and phrases should be in such a way that the listener feels affection and kindness and friendship rather than being unpleasant for them as a listener, you know? When the Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, says it in this particular way, الَّذِي يَلِينُ عَلَى مَسَامِعِهِ وَتُكَلِّمُهُ مِنَ الْكَلَامِ بِمَا يَطِيقُهُ عَقْلُهُ. That's exactly what it means, that when you want to say something, that these precise points that are going to be mentioned are going to have an effect on the other person, that you're not going to embarrass them, you're not going to defile their dignity, you are certainly going to deter them from sin and from error by admonishing them in such a way that it's going to have positive outcome and not a negative outcome. And that's why when it does come to, you know, the problem of some people suffering greatly from the dullness and the stain of their social dignity, where they were affected in a negative way because of the language that was directed at them, because the person who was giving them advice was not taking into consideration that person's emotions, their intellectual capacity, embarrassing them, doing so in public, and all of that having a negative effect. And of course, that's not going to be in any way guidance or counseling, but rather the exact opposite. And so that's why we do have a hadith that say that if you were to publicly advise someone, then you are in reality admonishing them, or it's a kind of abuse. You know, you're telling them off, you know, and they're not going to be taking that in the positive way. So we did mention that speech behavior and selection of words is always very, very important, and how they are employed and the effectiveness they can have in making the right impacts. And that's exactly what we are referring to when we mean that if you are the person who is delivering the nasiha, you need to take into consideration the mood, the effects, the intellectual capacity, the sensitivity of the topic, and far away from any kind of social stigma, and considering all the other elements and factors that are also involved as well. And that's why this beautiful section, it says, وَتُكَلِّمَهُ مِنَ الْكَلَامِ بِمَا يَطِيقُهُ عَقْلُهُ, and that you speak to them in such a way with gentleness and with such words that their intellect is able to comprehend and digest. We're going to continue on speaking about this topic in our next session, inshallah. And until then, if you wish to correspond with us, you are able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. And until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم.
The Light.
Welcome to The Light. A chocolate maker in the Belgian city of Bruges has come up with a novel recipe to boost business in the run-up to Easter.
When you're a classic chocolate maker, make very classic recipes. Caramels, praline, marzipan, and it's okay. We have classic bonbons too. But I think today, the customer wants to go on adventure, also when they are eating something.
The chocolatier's special concoction is a praline made of grass juice, Granny Smith apples, and an East Asian type of lemon. He believes chocolate contains a secret ingredient that can counter the lockdown gloom. Belgium is known as the chocolate capital of the world. The northern city of Bruges is in particular renowned for treating your taste buds to quality cocoa. However, the coronavirus pandemic has diminished foreign tourist numbers, with businesses now relying on local customers. This is heart-melting. A video of a stray cat carrying her sick newborn kitten to a veterinary clinic in Turkey is melting hearts online. Veterinarians were confused as a cat walked into their clinic clutching one of her kittens in her mouth. The cat then meowed for a long time and brought in a second kitten of hers. After a quick examination, the vets noticed that the kittens couldn't open their eyes due to an eye infection. The clinic staff immediately treated the animals, helping them open their eyes after a while. The stray feline and her kittens were placed in adoption after the completion of their treatment. In the heart of one of the oldest districts in the U.S. state of California, there's a historical little printing house that is receiving a new lease on life. The building and its equipment were slowly dying out, and its machines were good for scrap. The iconic printing house was on the verge of bankruptcy until a group of artists revived this beacon of traditional typography. They used what was already present in the building, including the tools and hand printing knowledge. Artists are able to print their new age designs using these old printing methods. Some of the machines date back to the late 1800s. La Linterna was first founded to print newspapers. Later on, it began printing cinema and concert posters for famous artists. Nothing marks the start of spring in Japan like cherry blossoms. This year, people try to enjoy the sakura season safely by observing health protocols. Scores of Japanese have flocked to Tokyo's Ueno Park and along the Magura River to see stunning cherry trees in full bloom. The light pink flowers symbolize fresh starts in Japanese culture. The cherry blossoms generally last from April to May. Thanks to this year's warmer weather, trees have blossomed earlier than usual. However, the number of people coming out to enjoy the season has fallen sharply due to the coronavirus pandemic. Some sakura festivals around the capital were also canceled.
In the heart of one of the oldest districts in the U.S. state of California, there is a historical little printing house that is receiving a new lease on life. The building and its equipment were slowly dying out, and its machines were good for scrap. The iconic printing house was on the verge of bankruptcy until a group of artists revived this beacon of traditional typography. They used what was already present in the building, including the tools and hand printing knowledge. Artists are able to print their new age designs using these old printing methods. Some of the machines date back to the late 1800s. La Linterna was first founded to print newspapers. Later on, it began printing cinema and concert posters for famous artists. Nothing marks the start of spring in Japan like cherry blossoms. This year, people try to enjoy the sakura season safely by observing health protocols. Scores of Japanese have flocked to Tokyo's Ueno Park and along the Meguro River to see stunning cherry trees in full bloom. The light pink flowers symbolize fresh starts in Japanese culture. The cherry blossoms generally last from April to May. Thanks to this year's warmer weather, trees have blossomed earlier than usual. However, the number of people coming out to enjoy the season has fallen sharply due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Some sakura festivals around the capital, Tokyo, were also cancelled. Asia's largest tulip garden has opened its doors to the public in the Indian-administered Kashmir. The event is expected to draw tens of thousands of enthusiasts this year after witnessing only few visitors last year following the COVID-19 lockdown. Shahanabad has more.
In between the foothills of the Zabarwan mountain range and the world-famous Dal Lake, Asia's largest tulip garden is now open to the public. Visitors are mesmerized by all the colorful flowers which are on display at the event. This seasonal exhibit is a major attraction for locals as well as tourists visiting this picturesque Himalayan region this time around.
People of Kashmir are eagerly awaiting spring because winters here are tough. For us, Navroz of the Persian New Year festival brings hope. And these flowers are the proof of the spring season. They please the eye and fill us with fresh energy.
In this garden, there are 51 different types of tulips, and caretakers of this garden work hard throughout the year to make sure the flowers bloom well.
This garden is God's grace, and to add to its beauty, we, a team of gardeners, are working year-round. We become delighted when we see visitors from different corners of the world come here to enjoy this beauty. It's a matter of pride for us when they compliment us on our hard work.
Amid the coronavirus pandemic, the number of tourists visiting Kashmir has drastically reduced. Now, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has taken to Twitter and urged Indian citizens to visit Kashmir's tulip garden.
Kashmir is a heaven on earth. This is what we had heard, but now we believe it. I have never seen so many flowers together. The beauty of this place is mind-blowing.
Kashmir, a tourism-dependent economy, has long been affected by the ongoing turmoil in the region, and now the coronavirus pandemic has added to the miseries of people here. However, people are hoping against the hope that sooner or later the region will witness lasting peace and prosperity. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Artificial intelligence is fast growing and already touching many aspects of our daily lives. And now, a humanoid robot becomes the world's first machine artist to ever auction its own digital artwork. What is this world coming to? The robot called Sophia sold the artwork, which was in the form of a non-fungible token, for nearly $700,000. Sophia, who was unveiled in 2016 by a Hong Kong-based company, produced her art in collaboration with Italian digital artist Andrea Bonassetto. The artwork is a 12-second MP4 file showing the evolution of Bonacetto's portrait into Sophia's digital painting.
So, thank you very much for joining with me and supporting me today. The virtual, the real, the imaginal, and the literal. This kind of spirit of creativity and technology working together gives me hope that we can solve anything.
And we've been exploring Sophia's creativity on the side, but we really have been developing her as a platform and as a character more than as a work of fine art.
Since her activation, Sophia has achieved widespread appeal due to her unsettling human-like appearance, compounded with the complex ability to express emotions. She has appeared on talk shows and spoken at conferences about issues ranging from artificial intelligence to the role of robots. Hansen Company says Sophia now has simulations of every major muscle in the human face and can generate multiple expressions such as joy, grief, curiosity, and frustration.
Nothing marks the start of spring in Japan like cherry blossoms. This year, people try to endure the sakura season safely by observing health protocols. Scores of Japanese have flocked to Tokyo's Ueno Park and along the Meguro River to see stunning cherry trees in full blossom. The light pink flowers symbolize fresh starts in Japanese culture. The cherry blossoms generally last from April to May. Thanks to this year's warmer weather, trees have blossomed earlier than usual. However, the number of people coming out to enjoy the season has fallen sharply due to the coronavirus pandemic. Some sakura festivals around the capital were also cancelled. A new study has revealed that octopuses probably dream while sleeping just as humans do. Scientists in Brazil believe that the eight-legged animals experience two sleeping phases, active and quiet. During the active stage, the octopus's skin color changes. They also move their eyes and twitch their bodies. According to the study, they might have short dreams in this period. To do their research, scientists observed four octopuses while they were sleeping in the lab. Mammals, birds, and some reptiles also experience a two-phase sleep cycle. Many people have experienced the healing power of music. Now, a violinist in Brazil has taken advantage of the popular idea to spread joy and calm in COVID-hit hospitals. Cristiano has volunteered to play the violin for patients and health workers in Rio de Janeiro. According to the violinist, music should be played in all hospitals as it renews hope and eases stress. He says people are more isolated during the coronavirus pandemic, so they need music more than ever to stay motivated. Experts believe music therapy can also reduce heart rate and blood pressure.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website,